the gist. Innovate, scale, succeed.
Today we're excited to welcome Melvin Lubega to The Gist. Melvin is the co-founder of the online education platform GoOne, which also happens to be South Africa's first unicorn. He's an actuary by training and an experienced technology entrepreneur and executive who has built businesses that serve customers across the world. Born in Johannesburg to Ugandan parents, Melvin is proud of his Ugandan heritage. He describes himself as one who always had a thirst for learning and scholastic achievement. This is evidenced by him attending St. John's College, the University of Cape Town, and Oxford University, all on scholarship. Prior to the startup journey, Melvin worked in investment banking and strategy consulting at Goldman Sachs and the Boston Consulting Group, respectively.
So Melvin, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome to The Gist. To start off with, perhaps you could just walk us through, you can walk us through who Melvin is, where you're from, the first venture, how you got to where you are right now.
Okay, wow. With so much time we have, I mean, ultimately, I guess who's Melvin? So Melvin, I guess, is a young African entrepreneur who's passionate about using technology to solve significant problems. And I think for me, when I think through my professional career, it definitely comes down to impact and job creation. And so my professional goal in life is to create 100,000 sustainable jobs. I am sorely far from that at about 500, but definitely that's the ambition that I hope to attain over my professional career. I mean, you know, if you ask me about my first venture, so I grew up in South Africa, parents are Ugandan by origin. And I've worked across the continent and around the world. But if you asked me about my first venture, it technically would have been when they first launched the green dustbins in Johannesburg. I don't know if any of you are from Johannesburg, but you know those green dustbins where you put like your rubbish and they come collect them once a week?
Yeah.
So when those first came out, like everyone was excited. They were all fresh and brand new. But like after 3 weeks, they all began to smell and stuff. And so I began a business trying to wash those dustbins. That's why someone wants to pay me to clean a dustbin. Who knew? But it made sense at the time. And so definitely probably the earlier venture that the earliest venture I did, but the most one I actually made money, was running a tuck shop in my boarding school and high school. But I think the benefit I had there was it was pre Uber Eats. So I used to get bread from the kitchen and then just buy cheese and bologna and make sandwiches at night. And I had this great arbitrage where if I made the sandwiches at the bottom of the stairs, the smell would linger across the boarding house. Everyone knew I was making and selling sandwiches. but, you know, I guess then very grateful it was before Uber Eats, because I definitely would have not been able to maintain or keep up with a Debonair's pizza or anything of that nature. So, yeah, look, I've always been trying to find opportunities to create value and ultimately capture that value, which I guess led us to our current business now being GoOne.
Cool. So I guess suffice to say, you've always been an entrepreneur at heart.
Yeah, you know, I reflect on this often, just when I think about my journey. And I think I've always wanted to add value in the communities and societies I find myself in. And I think that's why, you know, throughout my career, or even like my schooling career, I've always been drawn to like leadership positions, whether it's being head boy or SRC or at Oxford being head of Africa Society, because I always have this need to like serve my community, and that community can be clients, can be, and it's almost like a broader definition now where fine, I'm advising some of the members of parliament and stuff in South Africa, but it's something where I think it's almost been drawn in how does one better serve a community, and then for me on the commercial side, it's how do you capture some of the value that you create. And so I wouldn't say I've been an entrepreneur at heart, but I think I've always had an entrepreneurial mindset. And so probably through that lens, I would say it's almost looking at things and asking if they can be done better, and if I'm the one that can enable that to be done better more than anything else.
Yeah, that's amazing, Kia. I think the one thing we sort of fully support here at The Gist is definitely money and impact, and when they go hand in hand,
you can't help but be happy.
What do you guys actually do? Who are your end users?
And it's sad that neither you nor Tinder end users, but we shall rectify that after this call. but suffice it to say, so look, ultimately at GoOne, our reason to exist and why we do what we do is to help people unlock a positive potential in themselves through a love for learning. Because look, everyone has positive potential, and we feel that learning and development is a tool to enable that. And so how we express that is through our GoOne Learning, our GoOne Learning platform or ecosystem. To put it simply, almost a Netflix or corporate training, where we aggregate over 100,000 learning items, resources, courses in different formats, different styles, topics into one subscription library that we offer to customers. And so typically we're B2B, so we offer to organizations, governments, businesses, and so forth, looking to train their staff, volunteers, people, citizens, all that good stuff. And so from there, what we offer is, if you want to upskill in a particular, whatever, let's call it skill that you're trying to learn to improve your productivity, be better at your workplace, or be more employable, we would then offer that via the platform. So you'd come onto the platform, and then have the ability to pick from some of the content you have on the platform, which is some of the best providers in the world. So your Harvard's, Thomson Reuters, like a number of like leading providers that we offer content from on the ecosystem.
You know, what was the, for you and Andrew, I mean, you know, you're chilling at Oxford. what was the light bulb moment when you realized that you had something special, that there was an opportunity, particularly in the B2B edtech space, to kind of create something that was scalable?
Yeah. And, you know, it's quite prophetic that, I guess, you know, like ultimately the forming of the business was a function of the different experiences that the founding team and the co-founders experienced in their previous lives. And so, you know, Andrew came from a particular background in web development where his then girlfriend, now wife, was a teacher and had been building websites with high school mates for a number of years and was seeing learning needs. Whereas my exposure from the learning side was more so in the management consulting space and also doing, you know, early stage investing and realizing that the small businesses thought they weren't big enough to invest in training and development, yet the bigger businesses who were paying lots of money for consultants weren't getting that right. And so it was almost the same problem, but from different starting points that we found the genesis of what is GoOne today. But in the same vein, I think to your question around, you know, what was the spark when you were onto something? I mean, we knew that we always believe that, look, education is the most powerful tool you can use to change someone's economic circumstance. And so for us, from a passion and something which we knew, if you were able to get right and deliver value in, could have a phenomenal impact. It's always been education. Fortuitous that we met at an education institution. We're both studying in the UK at the time. And so from that perspective was more so the sharing of those ideas. So we're both doing our master's in education learning technology at Oxford. It came down to initially then, how do we offer brighter, more richer learning for because we just had different somewhat unpleasant experiences with current tools that existed in the learning space. But ultimately it was never a point where like, oh my gosh, you know, we're onto something. As some often say, look, it's a multi-year overnight success. And so from that perspective, I think one thing is you knew the opportunity was always there. It's always been a function of our execution towards that goal and objective. And by no means have we arrived there today, but we still believe that there's a significant opportunity to be captured, and we think we're best used to capture it in our space. So it wasn't like a particular moment per se, but more so realizing there's a phenomenal opportunity to create value in that space.
I think the one thing, you know, when you were describing kind of what GoOne is, you know, you talked about being the Netflix. I think the one thing I found quite interesting about your business is that you've said, you know, localized content is really important, and it seems like you've been really deliberate about partnering with local content providers, somewhat of what Netflix has made them really, I think, successful. Why was that important for you guys? Why is localized content important, particularly around education?
Well, so where we focus, professional learning, and I think it's interesting where early on we had a strong focus on compliance. And the reality is that compliance is often unique to geography. So, for example, in the UK, you have GDPR, but in South Africa, we have poppy or papaya. And so for you to remain relevant and add the most value, yes, you can drop a GDPR course and say it's generally the same as Poppy, but you won't be able to actually make someone more employable, because it's like you knowing, let's say, anti-money laundering for the US and knowing anti-money laundering for South Africa. Knowing the US won't help you be more employable or even be compliant to South Africa. So for us, there's a big element of localization for relevance, but also even in terms of teaching styles. I guess the final thing I'm saying is, like, for certain courses, for example, Microsoft Excel, there's no level of localization because Microsoft sells Microsoft Excel. So the question is, how do you leverage, you know, the best of breed globally and blend that with locally best-in-class content to provide a complete one-stop shop for training?
Got you. I guess another question that comes to mind for me is around, you know, what surprised you most about your growth as a business? I mean, you shared about, you know, how you guys got started, what it is Go One does, but like what surprised you so far about your journey thus far?
I think, so surprised, yes, but I think just the quality of and the caliber of people who've been able to come along with us on that journey. I think whether it's people, whether it is, you know, investors, partners, I mean, it's actually phenomenal thinking about it. I mean, I remember back in the early days where, like, you know, you're literally begging people to, like, partner with you, but now we're at the point where, like, people are actually, like, you know, it's the other way around. And so just seeing that, I think it's really been a function that people have been able to attract. Because, you know, coming from, like, guys, coming from an environment, let's say, like, I don't know, yeah, so worked in investment banking, London, Goldman Sachs, did the management consulting thing, BCG. These are environments of, like, you know, highly paid, you know, highly proficient people. And I think very early on in our journey, you know, just being able to attract talent because they've been what we're trying to build and they could see the vision as well. I think it's something which, for me, you know, it's easy to believe your own hype early on, but I think definitely staying true to the cause and just being true about where you see things are and what you want to build. I think just that vulnerability and the ability and how that's enabled us to attract good people. For me, that's been not surprising, but just surprising, just the quality of people that we have in the business today. And so that for me is yeah, something which, you know, coming from a corporate environment, I took for granted just the ability to mobilize people on different things. So that was definitely a big surprise. I think the other one is just more so, you know, something which I often task my managers to do is to look at their diaries, or look at their day-to-day a year ago and see if they're doing the same things or dealing with the same things that they're dealing with then. Because if they're dealing with the same things that they're dealing with that they were then, they probably haven't grown, or they're still micromanaging, or they haven't necessarily grown the people around them. And so for me, just seeing the growth of our people, and 5 years, 6 years isn't a long period of time, but just seeing how some of our, you know, early team members have grown to head up very large teams and just seeing their development as well. Again, not necessarily surprising, but definitely encouraging. I think it's something where, you know, people often say, like, you know, but in corporate, you need to do your time and do X number of years to get to this level. But I think it's something to be said around just spending time, you know, at the coalface and what that does for your growth and development. And I think for me, that's definitely been one of those when I look back, both in surprise and inspiration.
No, that's amazing. I feel as if we've kind of been hearing this a lot, I guess, this season with a lot of our founders, really around the idea of human capital and ensuring that obviously you have the right people in the right spaces. Do you think when you first started, this is something you really spent a lot of time thinking about, or it just was one of those natural things where with trial and error, you sort of got to where you are?
Oh, no, 100%. I mean, spent lots of time thinking about it. I mean, like, so at the beginning of the business, I used to head up all our sales, revenue generation, partnerships, and so forth. And I mean, there, like, it's interesting in the sales world, when someone is good or bad, it's very clear in their numbers. But I think it comes down to the kind of culture you want to build, the kind of company you want to build. And same way, even you think about, you know, picking partners in a business, or even the investors you bring on board. I think there's so many different levels of how, you know, as an entrepreneur, you have ways to actually curate, build, and develop the people. And also the enabling environment that people will thrive in. And so for us, it's always been intentional. And look, it's not without its false starts and its missteps, because the reality is, you know, we were building a business and also learning and building as professionals ourselves in the business. I mean, so we have, from very early on in our journey, been a remote or dispersed team. You know, from early on, we had teams in SA, we had teams in Australia, we had teams in Vietnam. And again, just trying to build a coherent culture across those different geographies wasn't necessarily, wasn't an it wasn't an easy feat per se, where it just happened organically. It was about being intentional about reinforcing cultural norms and creating one culture that was supportive of one team, which is a big value of ours as an organization. So it wasn't necessarily per chance, but something which we definitely have not only applied ourselves to a lot, but also learned a lot from on the journey.
That's a really good reflection. Maybe just switching gears a bit. We've all heard of the Big Five. Many people are probably not as familiar with the great big unicorns. How does it feel being, South Africa's first unicorn? Explain to our listeners kind of what does that actually mean? What does it mean to be a unicorn? This new status that you guys have just recently achieved.
So I guess from let's call it startup community perspective, what has become, I guess, a term now in this ecosystem has been what is termed, as you said, the unicorn. And essentially it's a startup that is valued at over $1 billion. And I think, it's truly humbling. And I think it speaks to the point I mentioned earlier, just the validation of the work that the team has been doing for the last 6 years in terms of just building up the platform. Because it's been the same culture, same people, just moving towards the goal and growing further to it. Look, it's a big number, as I mentioned, but with it comes a big responsibility. And so from that perspective, we've got some big things to do, but definitely excited for the next phase of growth. I think for us, I mentioned earlier that, the potential, the opportunity, particularly in our space, being education, learning and development, particularly when it comes down to professional learning, is a multi-billion-dollar industry. And so for us, we know that there's a lot more growth to take place. But I think to the point around, mythical creatures and unicorns, it definitely is a good validation of the work we've been doing thus far in terms of valuation.
No, it definitely is. I know we had this conversation at some point around fundraising and African fundraising and why you really don't see as many Africans or African-founded firms really doing the most in the sector. At this point, you've obviously gone through quite a few funding rounds, with the most recent really making you a unicorn. What sort of key lessons have you learned through these fundraisings, but also your latest funding round, or what will you guys be using that for?
Yeah, look, there's probably a whole dissertation behind the question of what one's learned from fundraising. But there are many things, right? I think the key thing is people invest in people. And, it's easy to say, you're talking about mega corporations and big investors, but ultimately people invest in people. And I think just one's ability to connect, being aligned in values, being able to show that you and your team can execute, all those things one takes for granted. It's ultimately people, because behind every corporation, behind GoOne, there are people, behind SoftBank, there are people, behind Social Ventures, there are people, Airtree, there are people. And so it's a big thing not to get lost in the technicalities of a deal and a transaction. And so for us, it was always thinking through, who are the partners, or what kind of partner would we want to enable the next phase of growth? And what's the next phase of growth was from us going from, after doing Y Combinator to getting to our initial traction from revenue perspective, whether it was to scaling our business, or even from us where we are now in terms of the next growth phase we want to go into. There's a different type of partner one requires for each part of those journeys. It's about being very clear, I think, as entrepreneurs and as founders in the business, to know exactly what that looks like. And in that way, you're then also able to use that as a way to determine who the investors you want to bring on board. And I think for us, it has been a journey. And, people, I think often, startup entrepreneurs, when you raise money, we don't do enough work to understand our investors or the potential investors we approach. That being said, we've been very fortunate. Early on, you'd have 100 meetings just to get to sign term sheets. Whereas now, as you've grown and scaled, and very fortunate to have considerably more interest in the business and the tables turning in that particular way. But it's definitely been an interesting journey. But I think definitely from learnings, I think it's about, if you ask me the question, I think one, people invest in people. So don't discount the other person you're speaking to, and people have motives, emotions, fears, and understanding those will help you find, one, the right partner, but two, even if you have, a partner, get the most value from the relationship. I think two is almost a function of, again, knowing what you want and need in a partner. And, I say, getting investors like getting married. You want to almost understand each other. You want to be able to go through the courting stages. But ultimately, when you want to commit, you want to know that you're committing to the right person and that person. And so for us, it's been very intentional. And I think ultimately, again, like, and something which I reflect on as well is, you know, raising venture capital isn't necessarily right for all types of businesses. And I think it's something which, you know, one needs to bear in mind, because, you know, I remember at one point in our journey, we were inflection point. We said to ourselves, like, look, you know, we built a very successful business and we can continue our organic growth path, or we can, you know, raise some additional venture capital and really, like, scale our growth. And it's about being clear about what your ambitions are and what you want to achieve in the business, to be able to determine, like, look, is venture capital right? Do I actually need more debt? Do I need, like, you know, revenue-based debt? Do I need grant money? And so I think it's easy to get in the happy loop of raising capital, but it's about being very intentional about whether it's the right thing for you to do, given where your organization is and the kind of ambition you have for your business. In terms of where we're at now, I mean, as I mentioned to you, still very early in our journey. We say internally, like, look, this is day one, because the reality is, you know, internally we say we want to train a billion learners globally. And so, you know, last month we celebrated having 3.5 million active learners in the platform. And so we're very, again, quite a far way away from a billion. And so for us, this is day one, but it's about saying, how do we use the capital we've raised now to further that mission of unlocking positive potential in people through a love for learning? And so in that, we're going to be doubling down on the markets that we currently are in and, you know, growing the teams there organically. In the same vein, also to the question I asked earlier, exploring new markets, particularly those that are ancillary. So, you know, doing a bit more on the continent in Africa, thinking about continental Europe as well, and in that particular way. But in the same vein, also just deepening our product offering and the types of content that we offer in the platform. So we announced the other week a strategic investment in a company called Noah, which is a Dublin-based media group. And so what they're really well known for is news over, Noah stands for news over audio, but essentially the leaders in the space of, you know, bite-sized news from some of the leading providers and leading news sources from around the world. Because, you know, people learn a lot through, you know, news and current affairs and so forth, especially in a professional setting. And just thinking through how best do we further that mission of positive potential. And so we'll use the funds accordingly in that way.
No, amazing. That's super insightful. And also congratulations on the users.
Thank you.
I think maybe sort of just taking a bit of a shift, something that sort of piqued my interest in the news lately, to be honest, considering that this is how I made all of my money when I lived in China, was China recently banned commercial tutoring and essentially appended a $100 billion industry in an attempt to quell education inequalities, well, at least according to them, obviously. So I guess when we think vastly different to what we think about when we speak about access to resources and the democratization of education through technology, a couple of questions for you on this. One, what's your view on this? Do you ever see a scenario where, I guess, Gowan would ever be affected by this? And then secondly, and maybe I think you might have answered this a little bit, do you ever see Gowan ever entering the pre-tertiary market where a lot of outcomes are decided within the South African and the African education context?
Yeah, look, I mean, if you're saying you made lots of your money when you were in China tutoring, I know you made a good amount of money, because I did my first master, I did research in China and spent a few months there. Everyone was just making so much money tutoring English. And I was thought, like, should I be, like, dropping my Oxford master's dissertation and just focusing on teaching English? Because the return profile was very different at the time. And I think, look, there's a very big industry. And I think, you know, especially English language learning, as an example, in China, phenomenally large industry, even from a population perspective. But just generally, the focus and prioritization that Chinese culture and people put on education is phenomenal. And I think, and therein lies the pressure from an inequality perspective, where, you know, the consumer surplus that is taken up by educational providers in China is phenomenal, just because parents are willing to pay so much, for example, to get their children ready for the Gaokao. So they're like big university entrance exam, as an example. So the idea is that the capitalist approach to, you know, capturing consumer surplus has created inequalities where those with the money can afford to pay and get their kids better training and preparation for exams to the point where they can exceed those that don't necessarily have the same resourcing. So I think it's also unique to the construct of China, given just the melting pot of different things that I've mentioned before. And so I wouldn't say like it's, and look, obviously the devil's in the detail where, look, as you mentioned, they're focusing on extra lesson type tutoring and private tutoring more than anything else, which I guess is outside of the core system. And I think what the challenge they're seeing is that that has created a level of exclusion inequality or exacerbated inequality. I wonder if, like, you know, look, I think, will that affect Go1? I think it definitely will, only because the reality is that, you know, one of the regulations I think was that, I think, private tutoring companies aren't allowed to IPO, I believe it is, or raise capital to public markets. And so that will significantly impact many of the early stage investors that were investing in edtech companies in China, thinking they're going to make an exit in IPOing, as an example. And so that will obviously impact the general sentiment towards emerging markets and tech. I mean, I don't think we're expecting the same level of coordination from, let's say, some of the countries we operate in terms of, like, say, the African continent. But look, we're still very excited by the opportunity that exists in China, just because it is such a large market, and, you know, we've explored a few partnerships there as well, and something we're looking to deepen over the coming years, because the opportunity is still quite phenomenal. And, you know, to get to your question, though, our focus is more on professional learning. So we want learning that will enable you to have greater economic or employability opportunities. And so we don't see in our medium to short term a focus on let's say pre-tertiary as you termed it. That being said, I mean, like, look, we do train a lot of teachers. I mean, some of our partners in our ecosystem, I mean, probably 1 out of 4 teachers in certain states in Australia are using Go1 for certain training and courses that they need to take, as an example. So we are, I guess, having our impact in, let's say, you know, secondary and primary education, but not necessarily directly. It's almost in saying investing in the teachers and professionals that enable that to take place, which, again, since I must make my degree go for something, if you look at some of the my degree was in education learning technology, focusing a lot on the education side of things. And so what you realize in some of the countries, let's say like Finland, who has phenomenal and is the world leader when it comes down to educational outcomes, some of the studies show that it was the investment in the teachers and teaching as a profession that enabled them to actually achieve what they achieved. So we hope that by doing so in our own way, we're contributing to that. But also we realize in life, like, look, we know B2B SaaS and B2B HR and tech. And so from that perspective, it's where we're able to play well. But we don't suspect in the future that we may necessarily preclude pre-tertiary education as well.
That makes a lot of sense. You're leaving the door open. That's a very entrepreneurial to have, not closing the door or anything. I guess, you know, thinking about looking at the outlook of the edtech space, I mean, I think it is an area that is growing rapidly, that is becoming, you know, increasingly competitive as you see different type of models, you know, looking at B2C, but also B2B and kind of breadth and depth of access to education. For you, Melvin, I mean, what are you most excited about as you think about the growth and opportunities in this sector?
So it's an interesting one where I think, you know, like, education is such a high impact area in terms of, like, you know, impact and like just development and change. And, you know, when you think about it as a standalone, but there's so much opportunity in terms of digitization. And if you think about the pandemic, what sadly the pandemic highlighted is just how vast, like, the digital divide is. And by digital divide, I mean the divide between those that have digital access versus those that don't. And I think it's been more acute in emerging markets, particularly on the continent of Africa, where that has been felt. And so I think even with something like education, which is often seen as, like, you know, a basic right and a must have, I think there's a lot of opportunity to unlock that. And I think people being able to build context specific and relevant solutions to bespoke problems in the educational ecosystem will do very, very well, because education is one of those things which you can both do well and do good at the same time, if that makes sense. And I think just having some of the smartest minds applying themselves or being attracted to that space, I think will do the area phenomenally well in terms of the development of what we're expecting. So I'm very excited for EdTech globally, but even more so on the African continent, just because of the amount of opportunities and also what you're seeing more and more entrepreneurs coming to the fore in that space.
That's exciting. I think we completely share your sentiment. I guess would love to ask you, if you had, for our listeners and I guess other entrepreneurs who are thinking about going on this journey or joining a Go1 for their career. What are like three pieces of advice that you wish somebody had told you, or that you kind of hold on to?
Yeah. And, you know, like I mentioned, you know, before we started recording, I think just the sharing school fees, as it were, I think, you know, ultimately I'm a big fan of making new mistakes. And so I want to learn from other people. And I mean, just from our journey to date, something has stood out to me. So, you know, and this is really something which one can reflect on, you know. And so I know that both, you know, Butler and Butler, you know, highly educated, you know, extremely successful. And I remember someone at Oxford once told me, you know, maybe we're too educated to be successful. And it comes to the point of, you know, if you don't necessarily put yourself out and apply yourself fully to what you're doing because you have outside options, because you can always go back to the comfy corporate job or whatever it is, if you want to be an entrepreneur, as an example. And I think for me, it just comes down to the point of not, and I see this in two ways. So one is not necessarily relying on perfection. Something I used to struggle with very early on in building up the business was, you know, some things which I learned in my consulting days around, like, you know, not being direct with people. So, like, if I disagreed with someone in my team, I'd almost, like, you know, corral, get them over the line, you know, why don't you think about it this way? Sure, that's the right approach, as opposed to being, like, no, your idea stinks. We're not going to do that. And I think it's those small things which I had to work out, because I was, like, in consulting. I was a king for that, because you could tell a client, you know, get them on site, co-create and build something of value. Whereas in a business where you have limited runway, you're early, you're small, and you have to, like, really punch, box smart above your weight, you know, sometimes just, you know, keeping the main thing, and it's not about feelings, it's about being, you know, having candor in a respectful way, is something which I took for granted. And so for me, that's almost like the whole narrative of, you know, done is better than perfect. And, you know, you think of an analogy where, you know, when Amazon began, there was actually a point in time where their shopping cart in the first version was actually off, so you could actually order negative books. So I guess the assumption was that, you know, you could technically take your books to Amazon and they'd pay you for them, as an example. And so it's those small things which I think in tech, you know, speak to someone like Reid Hoffman, who's the founder of LinkedIn. He often says, you know, if you aren't embarrassed by your first release of your product, you've released too late. And I think there's something to be said about having a bias towards action in building out a business. That's one of the key learnings, I'd say, over my journey, just being, having a bias towards action and, you know, getting going rather than standing still. I think in the same vein, you know, something which I can't appreciate, especially, I'm very grateful for the team I've had and my partners in the business, is, you know, no man is an island. And I think, you know, being able to collaborate with us, the partners, with co-founders, it can transform, you know, rather 50% of nothing than 100% of, 50% of something, 100% of nothing. And so for me, just the importance of having team members whose skills are complementary to my own, and even just like temperament complementary to my own, has been something which I took for granted, because, you know, growing up in a society where everyone's like, you know, I, me, be the leader, be the head boy, be the head girl, be the person. I think the importance of collaboration and going on the journey with other people changes the experience totally. And so very grateful for the decisions you made early on in that particular way. And the final one is one which I think applies even outside of the entrepreneurial setting, where, you know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, success comes in opportunity meets preparation. And I think, you know, if you want to go somewhere, whether that's even a professional career in a corporate or as an entrepreneur, the question you have to ask yourself is, what are you doing to prepare yourself for that opportunity? Like, how are you prepared for that next level that you want to get in your life? And I think for me, just as an entrepreneur, just thinking through, you know, given our ambitions as an organization, as even as individuals, like making sure that we are continually growing and preparing ourselves for that next level of growth has been highly impactful, because when you meet that Microsoft executive in an elevator, you can lay down your pitch really strongly. Or when you happen to come across someone who you think would be great fit for your team, you have a clear sense of how they could fit into your organization and come along the journey with you. And I think it's something to sit around that preparation, because you can't necessarily control for the opportunity side of things. Those would probably be the three things that I would say would be key for my journey. I think one, just, you know, have a bias towards action, because done is better than perfect. Two, you know, no man is an island. And so through that, I believe collaboration is the ultimate key to success. And three, just making sure that you're preparing for what you expect next in your journey.
Yeah, just start collaboration, and fortune favors the well prepared. I can definitely get behind that.
No, thank you.
Well, I mean, Melvin, I mean, I think from our end, I mean, I think, I mean, that's it. I mean, I don't have any other questions. B, I don't know if you do.
No, I don't. But I think this has been super insightful. It's really amazing seeing all the great things that GoOne is actually doing to sort of
obviously link more consumers, link more users, and increase access, to be honest. I think that's something that, like, we're so behind as a continent. And so even with your scaling ambitions, it's so great to hear that this is something you guys are going to be concentrating on.
100%. No, really, shout out to you guys for what you guys are doing on this platform. I think, you know, one, telling the narrative, but also I think taking a different perspective on the narrative is so important.
Definitely. Well,
Melvin, thank you so much for your time. We'll be buying the book. Just let us know. We'll pre-order it as soon as possible.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And good luck to you and your team. We'll be cheering you guys on, but excited to see how Go One just continues to grow and scale and impact here on the continent, but globally. We're really excited to see it.
The Gist is creating new African narratives through disseminating key lessons and best practices from some of the continent's leading entrepreneurs and businesses.